On this episode of Aviator Cast, we speak to my friends John and Rose Dorsey.
Welcome, aviators, to another episode of Aviator Cast. Load up your flight bag with useful flight training topics, interviews, and aviation passion. Let's kick the tires and light the fires. Coming to you from Angle of Attack Headquarters in Homer, Alaska, here's your host and flight instructor, Chris Palmer.
All right, welcome aviators to another episode of Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. I'm a flight instructor. I have a flight school in Homer, Alaska, and I create lots of online content, including this podcast. I also do YouTube and Instagram, which you can check out. Today on this podcast, I get to speak with John and Rose Dorsey. Now, John and Rose Dorsey are very near and dear to my heart. John was the CFI that helped me get my CFI. Actually sought him out through some professional sources, and we had collaborated and worked on some things together through an organization. And then I decided, hey, I want one of the best to go with, and I'm going to go with John. And so he was gracious enough to allow me into their lives for a week or so. And then I got to know Rose really well, extra at that time, because I stayed with them in their home. Rose went through quite an interesting situation as she was going through her training. So we go through this podcast, we talk about her background, talk about the fact that she did her instrument with John being the CFI, and while they were engaged and soon to be married. And that's a funny story. But during her commercial training, which was, in her actually fairly recently, just a handful of years ago, she was about to take her check ride and had a brain aneurysm, and a very scary situation. We talk about that she talks about it. I don't really talk all that much in today's podcast, but just an amazing story. Lots of miracles in between. And I think there's a lot of fun stuff here from the perspective of a couple that both enjoy and love and are involved in aviation all the time. And I just really appreciate their positive attitude and perspective on it. And then also from the perspective of overcoming obstacles from Rose's perspective. So today's podcast is all about Rose. There was a previous podcast about John's journey that you can find. I'm not sure which episode it is. It's going to be pretty far back. And then John and I talked about meeting up in another episode. So that is what we're going to be covering today. This ended up being a fantastic podcast, and I can't thank Rose enough for coming to tell her story, and I'm excited to share it with you guys. Just as a couple of notes, if you are here on YouTube and you enjoy this as you're listening or watching, please subscribe and turn on that notification bell and join in the comments and let me know if this is what you thought about this podcast. And if you guys have any messages for Rose or John, you can leave them there too, and I'll point it out to them. If you're on podcasts, you'll be listening to this as well. Please subscribe there, whether it's on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play. It's pretty much everywhere. And I'm going to incentivize you to leave a review. So if you leave a review and I read it on the show, whether that be on any of those platforms for podcasts or on YouTube, I think YouTube's going to end up working a little bit differently. Like, you need to subscribe, notification bell, and leave a comment, and that will be your entry into getting a free t-shirt or a hat, is basically what I'm saying. So leave a review or go through that YouTube process, and I'll read your comment on the show, or I'll read your review on the show, and you can get a free hat or shirt. Okay. So I'll be doing one of those a week here coming soon. Just going to get some of those gathered in and then start to share them. And happy to share that with you guys, and really appreciate your support. You are what keeps this podcast going. And, I know we're taking a little bit of a tangent here recently, and I'm not sure it's so much of a tangent as this is, I think, the best thing that we can do with the podcast right now is start to share other people's stories. Because as I reflect back on having just done this interview with Rose, this is such valuable content, really such a valuable story that I can't think of anything better to share with you guys. So thank you for your support. Thank you for being here. I hope that you enjoy this time that we get to spend with John and Rose Dorsey. All right, everyone, we're honored to have T two very special guests with us today, some dear friends of mine, some of the best people I know, John and Rose Dorsey from Wisconsin. How are you guys?
Hi, Chris. Thanks. Wow.
So we were, I actually recognize the kitchen. I have spent some time with you guys. I actually did my CFI with John and got nurtured by you, Rose. And, you know, I had many lunches with you guys. So, we're really good friends and you guys have done a lot for me. And John, we need to get you on and talk about instructor stuff. But today it's going to be all about Rose. Rose, we want to talk about you and your journey and...
Alrighty.
Yeah. So take us back. What was the beginning of your aviation journey? Because from what I understand, you actually started before you met John. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in a little tiny village in central Wisconsin. And I lived very near to cranberry marshes. And in the spring and the fall, the crop dusters would always be out. And I remember, I don't know, maybe I was 10 years old, hearing those airplanes, and I would hop on my bike and I'd ride down to the end of the street and just watch those airplanes. And I was so in awe of them because they were, they were big and loud and they swooped down low. And I just thought it was the coolest thing. And I even remember one time when I was very, very young, an airliner, going over my house, and I was wondering about all the people, on the airplane and, who were the pilots and those kinds of things. But I didn't start flying until I was, on my 30th birthday, I had my first flight lesson. And, I always wondered what my hometown looked like from the air. So I had an opportunity to go up. And the pilot was a friend of mine, and he said, "Well, sure, we can go do that, and we'll do it like a introductory flight lesson." And so I said, "Sure." So I was in the pilot seat, and when we took off, I was maybe 20 feet in the air, and I said, "Oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing ever! I'm going to learn to fly." And so you can still hear my enthusiasm. It was very exciting, and so I started flight training. About a week later and got my private. That was in 1991. I got my private about a year later in 92. And then in 10 years later, I worked with John on my instrument rating. And then about 4 years ago, I started working on commercial. And that's when we had some interesting things happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's stay in the very beginning there. So you were, so when you went through that in 91, mm-hmm. I'm not sure which age the kids were, but they were still kids, right? I mean, what was it like to juggle that being a mom at the time?
Yeah. It was a little bit difficult. They were 4 and 8 and, so they were in either preschool or grade school already. And so I would try to schedule flight lessons while the kids were in school. I was fortunate I had my in-laws at the time or my parents who were watching the kids. And it was a real fun thing to talk about with my kids too, because they would start drawing pictures of airplanes and I was going through some boxes of old stuff the other day, and I found some like birthday cards that my kids drew that had airplanes on them and stuff like that. So it was, it's good when you have family support close by to, help with babysitting and things like that. That was good. But and then all the ground school I did mostly in the evening when the kids were already in bed. So it worked out good.
Yeah, I just think of like Chelsea, my wife, doing anything like that. Like she just tries to get a little spare time. But we're in a different stage too. We have a 3 and a 1 year old, so it's chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I've always, I've always honored mothers that somehow get through this, because it is a hard, hard job to be a mother, but to juggle it with also doing flight training. All the men are out there complaining about how hard it is. And here you are, a mother with 2 kids, 4 and 8, trying to do it. So that's just real impressive.
Thanks. Yeah, It was like I said, it's a real fun thing to talk about with your kids, and I would take them to the airport and we'd look at the airplanes and especially with my daughter, she was a little bit older at 8, and so we talked about the weather things and it was a lot of fun to kind of share it with them. So
what's the where did you get involved with like women in aviation? Because you're involved there too, right?
I'm not sure if
that was so much a thing back then or like where you got involved with it.
I actually joined the 99s as a student pilot. They called them 49 and a half. No, that was the men. I was a 66. That's what it was. Okay. I forgot about that. And so I was a student pilot and I can't remember. I think I went to one of their events. It might have been at AirVenture. But then I went to one of the meetings and I met some really great people who are very, very supportive. So I became a member of the 99s and just recently I just reconnected when John and I go to Alabama for the winters and through Facebook, a friend of mine who used to live in Wisconsin that I met through the 99s reached out to me, and they were having a 99s meeting in Gulf Shores near where we stay. So I got together with them. I went to one of their meetings and again, I had that great, all those great people that you meet through organizations like the 99s and Women in Aviation. I was very involved with that as well. I was one of the, I was the president for a while of the local chapter here in Oshkosh, and they're both really great in organizations. You know, they have so many good scholarships and just having that, those people who, as you know, anyone who's passionate like you are about something, it's good to have groups like that around you. So.
Yeah. So for those women that are listening that maybe don't know, maybe you're new to aviation, there are primarily those two organizations, right? The 99s and Women in Aviation that are very supportive of assisting and supporting women in aviation, and really cool heritage there too with both of them. They do a lot of good work.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I highly recommend any woman who's thinking about training, doing flight training, or is a pilot already. It's still very important to stay connected to those organizations, and you get a great magazine from Women in Aviation, and it just helps kind of fuel your fire, I think.
Yeah, I'd imagine that, especially with like-minded individuals and seeing other people succeed. I've heard it's really helpful. I know it has been for me. So, in other ways. So you got your private pilot license. Mm-hmm. The kids are still growing up. Did you stay active as a pilot while they were growing up?
As the kids started getting, their mom and dad were pretty active in things, and of course they got really active in things. So then about a year, I think, after I got my private, I was still flying, but then I slowly, was kind of cutting back because, we just had, they were going to basketball and football with my son and BMX racing and soccer and all that stuff. And so I just kind of, let it fall to the side because I knew I could go back to it whenever it was the right time. So I took a few years off and then started getting back into it again, and then decided, well, what better way to get back into it than go after the instrument rating? So that's when John and I started working on that. And we did kind of an accelerated program. He took 10 days off work or 2 weeks off work, I guess it was. We flew every day. We'd drive 45 minutes from my house to the airport, and then we'd go flying in the morning, and then we'd take a quick break for lunch and kind of debrief the flights, and then we'd go flying again in the afternoon. And I think we ended up flying 43 hours in in 10 days. I thought it was 10 days.
Maybe 14 days or so.
14 days, whatever.
It was intense, as she said.
Yeah.
Not only from that perspective, Chris, but she came to the CFI with absolutely nothing. She had a lot of time, but her written wasn't completed. Her medical was out of date.
I had done written 10 years before that.
Yeah. Right.
So I had to do it all over again.
So it provided lots of opportunities for interaction between two. And we had developed a relationship before we started the flight training. So now all of a sudden, I'm not just teaching a student client, but I'm teaching my fiance. So that was just a little extra pressure. And we might as well do it in the hottest 2.5 weeks of the summer in Wisconsin. Let's see, what else? Oh, planning a wedding. Sure, we'll throw that in there too. Why not? So, lots of challenges.
Lots of challenges. And I know we've told you this story before, Chris, but after, it gets a little heated sometimes between people you love. And it was a different instructor-student relationship, So so if we get ticked off about something, we didn't hesitate to let each other know. And sometimes you would be more professional about that with just, another CFI who you might hire. So we had a couple of interesting moments where I didn't know if the wedding was going to go on, let alone the instrument rating. But
yikes!
But we persevered and it worked out very well. Yeah. So
it seems like the perfect stress test for a marriage, though. Like if you can make it through that, you are good to go.
Overall, it was a very, very good experience. And we always talk about this part of it where we got a little stressed. Stress is a nice word for it, I guess. But honestly, I wouldn't do it any differently. I love that accelerated, 10-day, 2-week, whatever it was, program that we did together. What John was saying, I needed my medical and my instrument written within those 2 week those days. And so, I should have had those done before we started, but regardless, it happened and I got the result. We got the result we were looking for. So had a good instructor.
Well, I think that's the key here. So I have all my alarms going off as an instructor over here. Written isn't done. Haven't done it in 10 years, 2 weeks.
Exactly.
So John, taking a tangent, is like an accelerated course like that just off the shelf with anyone off the street? Is that something you recommend? I get that question a lot.
So it really, and I'm glad you presented it like that, the question like that, Chris. And what I would do always is do an interview with the clients before I get started and try to figure out what their goals are, their availabilities, what they've got pre-work already done, some of the road bumps, those little hidden potholes that we may not have, he or she may not have been aware of before we got started. So that way we both know what we're working with. And then we try to set up a plan of action. But I think it's a special person that can, both as a flight instructor and as a student, to do that in a 2-week thing. For some folks, absolutely. I've worked with medical folks, people that just can't get away very well on a schedule, because their schedule isn't theirs. So for those folks to be able to take 2 weeks, 3 weeks out and do it, that may absolutely be the best way to do it. My recommendation to anybody considering that would be listening to this is talk to an instructor that is looking at that kind of an opportunity for you as well as them. Because it's a big time commitment on the instructor side as well.
Huge,
right?
Yep, huge. And sacrifice for family and everything. You're all in all day.
Exactly. And not that we did it quite like that with you and your CFI, but yes, we did.
It was
And we did it, as you mentioned in the intro here, in our house. We were together literally 24/7. And that afforded us a lot, especially working on that CFI, a lot of opportunities for philosophical discussions, those kinds of things that you you get when you're working on your CFI, but to do it around the dinner table, you know, what a great opportunity. Yeah.
Right. So let's get your resume a little bit so people understand, since you just came into the picture of Rose's life. And speaking of coming in the picture, there's our friend Buddy.
Yeah, Buddy's jealous. He was crying because he couldn't sit by us.
So. He didn't want you to think that we were abusing our dog. My resume started, I was eight, took a penny a pound airplane ride as a kid, flew over my house, my school, said, that's it. That's what I want to do for the rest of my life. And been really blessed to be able to do exactly that. So I went into, in 1969, I went into the Air Force just as an enlisted guy, worked on a missile system, started meeting pilots, people in my squadron were pilots, those kinds of things. And it really fueled that. I'd actually started taking training before I got to my permanent duty station in North Dakota. Again, as we mentioned earlier too, surrounding yourself with like-minded folks does so much, whether it's online or in person. So I continued to do and build on that. Then as I became a second termer, I re-enlisted. Now the GI Bill was available, so that accelerated my opportunity to learn to fly. By the time I'm getting out of the service, I was a young CFI with about, 200 hours of dual given, about 450 hours of total time. And I sent out resumes to everybody thinking, who wouldn't want to hire me, right? and sadly, that was at the biggest pilot glut that we had seen probably since World War II. So 450 hours just wasn't going to do it. But I got a nice recommendation from a chief pilot at a corporation based in Wisconsin. Said, John, if you want to get a flying job, go get your A&P. And I thought, geez, I've just been wrenching, albeit on a missile, for the last 6 years. I don't want to do that. But I took his advice, best piece of advice I ever got. In that time, I added my double I, added about 600 hours of flight time in those 2 years, got the A&P, and never looked back. Always had another opportunity. Just all I had to do is say yes. So it's worked out very well. Ended up being the chief pilot for the Department of Transportation, Wisconsin, for 22 years, managed the airport operations portion of it here at Oshkosh for 5 years. And then, even better, we retired and still flying like crazy. Still fly. Yep. I probably did last year about almost 250, 300 hours somewhere in there, dual given. Yeah.
Wow.
Crazy.
The current thing you guys are doing when you go when you're being snowbirds, going down to, where is it? Alabama? Is that where you're going?
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
So that's interesting what you're doing down there, John. So just share that real quick.
Sure. So we're just literally about 35 minutes from the Naval Air Station at Pensacola, where the Navy does their flight training and a lot of other flight training gets done. What the Navy does is after you get accepted into their program, they will farm out their aviation cadets to five FBOs in the immediate area. Some are in Florida, some are in Alabama. And those FBOs, flight training facilities, will take these students up through SOLO. And then we turn them back to the Navy, where they actually get started then in the Navy program. So I've been fortunate enough to do that for a couple of years. And boy, oh boy, you can't help but get excited. 21, 22 year old kids right out of college. And all they want to do is go flying and talk about it and breathe it at the airport and stuff. It's just so exciting.
Yeah. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, it is.
What's the flying club flying you do?
And then, I do a lot of flying club work here in Oshkosh and some Piper Cub stuff down by Milwaukee. So yeah, keeping very busy.
You always are. Yep. You're very, very active as an instructor. It's that pedigree that that led me to want to do my CFI with you. And maybe we can touch on that later. Let's get back to Rose. Let's get back to the time frame of getting the instrument done. Now you guys are clearly got married. Everything worked out. So what was your flying marriage like from then on out leading up to the event, which we'll talk about here in a bit?
Well, we mostly did, you know, flying around the state of Wisconsin. We did one thing that was really fun. But I can't remember what year it was, maybe 2010 or so.
Oh.
We had this harebrained idea that we wanted to visit every county in Wisconsin that has a public use airport. So Wisconsin has 72 counties, and 60 of them at the time had public use airports. So we made four separate flights, and we went to all 60 of those airports. And we didn't want to just do like a touch and go. We wanted to actually stop and, you know, walk in and talk to people or meet people, whatever. And so we divided it almost evenly between the 60 airports, and then did these four different flights throughout the summer. And that was a real fun thing. I started a blog, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what it was called anyway, but it's still out there somewhere. but you know, I took a bunch of pictures and kind of explained, you know, the planning that it takes to do something like this.
And lessons learned.
Remember, and the lessons learned. Yeah.
First trip was.
Well, yeah, because the first trip we did, I think we were trying to go for
19 airports.
I yeah, think. And we oh we gosh. Ended up cutting one short because it was just getting too long of a day, you know.
Yeah. So this isn't one day.
Yeah, that was one day.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, we left probably at, you know, let's say 7 in the morning, and, you know, I don't know, it was late in the day when we got back. Yeah. I mean, it was still light out, but it was, and, you know, it was hot again.
And it's not like we were sharing flying duties. I was strictly running the radio and logging touchdown, taxi time, stuff like that. I was just kind of a co-pilot record keeper. And she was doing all the flying. And back when I was flying for a job, that, you know, long days were more normal. But for somebody that just do recreational flying, this was something entirely different.
Right.
But she did great. But again, lessons learned, having some snacks along, the water thing, all those things. And that's what she would put in her blog about, don't make this mistake.
It was called Flying Wisconsin. What was that format I can't remember what it was called. But anyway, if you look up, you know, like Rose Dorsey Flying Wisconsin, you'd find it. And it turned out to be a really neat thing. And we had a lot of people then later, like EAA chapters and other flying clubs invited us to come and talk about that because, you know, people say they thought about doing something like that, but they just never did it.
We always look for a reason to go flying, don't we?
Yes.
And this was a great opportunity.
Yeah.
Not only that, but we landed at grass runways and towered airports and lots of non-towered airports, of course, here in Wisconsin. Windy weather, and so we were doing crosswinds and short fields, and it was the flying that you flew in the weather that you got. So yeah, it was a great opportunity.
Well,
what's that?
I was gonna say, except for that one day we didn't go at all because of weather. I mean, it's really tough in a, you know, big state like Wisconsin. That you just never know what the weather's gonna be like. So
right.
But anyway, yeah.
We flew 60 hours in doing those 60 airports.
Wow.
So yeah, and we did it over a summer. So the point was we wanted to get Rose active as much as we could, and we did that in a big way with 60 hours in about 3 months. But we certainly enjoyed it, learned a lot, and we were able to share the story with not only online, but as she mentioned, with a lot of presentations to people.
Yeah,
that's really neat. I think it's a good opportunity as well to pivot to talk about Wisconsin aviation a little bit. I know you guys are. We can talk about the Hall of Fame for a second. I just know that when I spent time there, it's like a mecca. I know we all think of Air Venture, right? But there's a lot going on there, even during the summer. I think you guys have like a passport book or something. There's like a burger cookout each weekend somewhere else that you can go. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, there's Jeff Geyer and John Schmiel, who I think you've met both those guys, one from Marshfield, Wisconsin, and one from Wausau. And they started this, I think that started as what they call a putt-putt club, where they just invited people to come and have a burger at their airport. And it's turned out to be this huge thing. And It's the Wisconsin Airport Hamburger Social, I think, mm-hmm. is what they call it. And so they have all these different airports all over the state, and now it's grown to other states too, where either the flying club or the airport itself or different groups actually invite people to come and have a hamburger, and all they ask is a donation. Mm-hmm. And they'll get 50 or 60 airplanes coming, and it's usually around, I think it starts maybe around 4:30 in the afternoon, and starts probably May or June, and goes through fall, and then it shuts down again. But it's just an amazing program that started small, and it's just grown tremendously. And then besides that, there's a lot of of course we've got the world-class EAA Aviation Museum here, but there's other smaller aviation museums through the state and throughout the state, so that's very cool. There's a very small Deke Slayton Museum in tiny Sparta, Wisconsin, and then down in Sheboygan there's an aviation museum there, and then way up in Superior, the Dick Bong, the world's in Sheboygan, and then the Dick Bong Museum in Superior's. He's the ace of aces, of course. So there's just so many things, so many places to go to, whether you're flying or driving. There's a lot of aviation in the state, and then there's even the Wisconsin historical markers that you see on the side of the road. I don't know. Last time we checked, I think there were maybe 25 or 30 that have, aviation roots.
Connections.
So that's a pretty cool thing, too. So aviation, it's alive and well here in Wisconsin. So
yeah, it's real healthy. And I don't know if it's because of the proximity to EAA. I think it has something to do with it. But I just get the sense it has a lot more to do with just Wisconsin people and how they are. Like, it just seems like that's the hospitality that you guys have, and that's what you do, seems natural.
We're just that way.
Proper reason to get together, and we'll do it. The Wisconsin Aviation Hall of Fame is kind of that same idea. It started in 85, and it was really developed for a couple of reasons, but primarily recognizing folks that make a name in aviation history, either in the state or they're from the state and do it outside. And Rose was president for a long time, and I was on the board of directors. But the good works that organization has done with scholarships, it's unbelievable. Mm. Just a twinkle in one of the board members' eyes, and about 15 years later now, we're giving away five and maybe six now different scholarships to kids. And just doing great and wonderful things, whether it's an engineering school or a meteorology student, or they have to have an aviation connection. But that's about it. And be from Wisconsin to get the scholarship. And we went and told the story, 100 years of aviation in Wisconsin. We went and had a big celebration where that happened. It was a gentleman. It was actually, this is kind of interesting for all of your listeners and viewers, in that the first airplane sold to an individual in the country was sold to a guy from Wisconsin called A.T. Warner, kind of a genius on his own right. He had like 80 patents when he finally died. But he was 40 when he buys this airplane. He gets it in a box, comes from St. Louis, which is where there was an air show in 1909. Glenn Curtis had flown it, shipped it up on a train, know how to put the airplane back together manual in the box. So he's doing it kind of on his own at a farm, and goes down to the hardware store and buys some extra parts he thought it needed. And so that experimental thing was kind of alive and well in 1909, right?
Interesting. So, wow.
Yeah. It's kind of a great story. So he invented something that you use just today. He invented the speedometer.
Really?
Yeah, the automobile speedometer. Yeah. So if you ever look at some of the instrument gauges, even yet today, it says Stuart Warner. Warner was actually this gentleman, but yeah.
No kidding. Dang.
Yeah. That's your needless to know piece of information from me today.
Well, hearing all that makes me really really miss Wisconsin. It's hard because, I mean, speaking big picture, wherever I go, I leave a little bit of my heart, but I left a little bit more in Wisconsin. You know, I've been there several times and with you guys, and it just makes me want to go back.
You can consider this place your home away from home. You're always welcome.
I appreciate that. And I know it is. I know that as a fact. So, Rose, then you guys have your great adventure. You hit those 60 airports. Obviously, John is always in aviation. He's always instructing. And then you guys have your sights on the commercial license, and you start working on that.
Yeah. I mean, I had thought about doing that for a long time. And so finally we started working on that, and the training was going very, very well. Mm-hmm. We started in fall of 2016, and we had the commercial check ride scheduled for, I think, the 21st of December. Mm. And we flew over to Marshfield, where we rented one of Duffy Geyer's high performance airplanes there, and did a little flying, in prep for that. And so it was going well. And then on December 15th, we kind of were doing, I guess we could call it, a mock check ride with John and I, and we were flying for about 2.5 hours, and it was super cold that day, and so we decided to land because of the maneuvers we were doing, we were inching closer and closer to Fond du Lac, which is just south of Oshkosh, and they pumped the gas there. So we decided we were going to get gas there because it was so cold that day. Mm-hmm. And so after about 2.5 hours of flying, we landed there, got gas, ran inside. I took pictures of the airplane sitting on the ramp, and then we hopped back in the airplane and flew back to Oshkosh. And I don't know, I think you'd agree. John felt I was ready for the check ride. Yep. So that was, that was just great.
This was a Friday. She'd be taking the check ride it's Thursday. Yeah. And she'd be taking the check ride, I think it was on Tuesday. So this was pretty close to the last flight that we were going to do and prep for the ride.
Yeah. And then we flew back to Oshkosh and landed as per usual, we taxied up to the hangar, and John said, "Well, I'll hop out of the airplane. I'll go open the hangar doors, and you take care of the paperwork." So, and I don't know if you want me to just jump right into this.
Go right in, and John, you can jump in too, because your perspective is different too. I know there's two sides of the story, so just go ahead.
So he ran to open the hangar door, and I remember reaching behind the passenger seat to grab the flight log and opening it up and looking over at the Hobbs meter, but then I don't remember writing down the time. And the next thing I remember is John pounding on the airplane window saying, "Rose, are you all right? What's going on?" And I kind of felt like I was coming out of some daze or consciousness or something. And I told him I had the worst headache of my life. And he said he could, he knew something was wrong. He yelled at me to open the door. And he said it looked like I was having great difficulty trying to get the door open. But I was able to get the door open, and he helped me out of the airplane, and he said, "I'm going to take you to the hospital." So he walked me, I was very, very weak, and he walked me over to the car, and he turned on the heat, and he said, "I'll put the, airplane away and then we'll go." And, seconds later, I started beeping the horn, and he came running back, and I said, "We have to go right now. Something's wrong. I said, something's wrong. I can feel pounding in my head, or knocking in my head. That's what it was, knocking in my head. Mm-hmm. And then I looked up and I saw the fire station. The airport has a fire station. And I said, do you think the paramedics are there? And so I was still, I mean, I was in great pain. But I wasn't, you know, I didn't lose consciousness or anything. And so he said, well, I'll take you there. And so he, you know, drove over, and it wasn't very far. It's like
about 300 yards.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, drove over. He ran inside the back door and he said, you know, he thought it was having a stroke. So
I didn't really know, but got their attention, whatever. Yeah. I said,
I think you said what he told me was, you know, I need help. I think my wife is having a stroke. And so, so I remember sitting in the front seat and I saw these paramedics coming out of the fire station, and they helped me out of the car and they set me on the back, first on the bumper of a fire truck. And by this time I started kind of losing it a little bit. I was having a hard time. My speech was slurred and, I started vomiting and about that time, that's where I lost consciousness. And after that, I don't remember anything till about 4 days later, I think. And, so the paramedics took me to the Oshkosh Hospital, and about an hour and a half later, they called, Theta Star, the, emergency flight helicopter, and they flew me to ThetaCare, which is about 9 nautical miles. Just 9, but every minute counts. So what happened is I had a ruptured brain aneurysm, and I was 4 days unconscious, and then they and at that time they really didn't know what was gonna, I mean, and they didn't know if I was going to survive, and they didn't know if I'd have any would I be able to walk or talk or anything like that? And what were the statistics that they told you?
So pretty much and the story that Rose has just related has been replayed a lot. So and a little tough too.
Right.
But,
thanks, Rose.
But the statistics are horrible. First of all, I will say, for any pilot, we were just minutes away from being still in the air, right? I mean, literally, we were probably on the ground less than 4 minutes. I'm sure all of the viewers are familiar with runway 31. It's typically closed during air venture, but our hangar is right near the fire station up on the northwest end of the runway. So we landed on 31, one turn, and we were on the taxiway in front of our hangar. 4 minutes later, she's struggling. So the statistics that the doctor shared with me, though, were scary. Can't say it any other way. So of people that suffer cerebral hemorrhage of an aneurysm, they're divided into thirds. Usually a third of the people don't make it to the hospital. So that's what I was going to say, was about speed as being a big thing. If somebody says they got a headache, don't think, oh, take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning kind of a thing, because it may be something a lot more significant than just a headache. The second third will not survive the repair procedure. And then the final third will have 50% of that final third will have some kind of significant deficiency. Blind, they won't be able to speak, they won't be able to walk, those kinds of things. So that was the prognosis that we go into I go into the ICU. She's in there. That's what the neurosurgeon is laying out for me. And I'm going,
wow.
Kind of a smart aleck thing. I said, well, doctor, at least we're over the first hump. You know, we made it to the hospital. So
right.
21 days later, we walk out. Literally walk out. So
And I'm doing great. It feels like a miracle.
It is.
And that was very hard to deal with at the beginning. You know, why am I still here? Why, you know, so many other people don't survive this. But I was surrounded by people who prayed well and hard. my daughter, I think you know, she's a Dominican sister. And one of the very first things I remember when I woke up after all this is my daughter. And I mean, I could barely, you know, I was only probably awake, you know, for a couple minutes. But the first thing she said is, Mom, don't worry. All 350 sisters are praying for you. And so, you know, we had really good, fast medical care, and we had so many people praying for my recovery, and it worked out, you know, so beautifully. And I give thanks every single day that I'm alive to be here to tell this story.
The idea that the trauma center was only 9 miles away, that the paramedics at the, it starts with the paramedic. Well, we get there quickly. Starts with the paramedics. They were quick to get us there at the hospital. They do things that were life support and started the initial triage to figure out what's going on. Getting us to the med flight helicopter, Theta Star, and then probably the sad thing is we didn't get any dual on the helicopter for Rose. It wasn't very long, but you know, I always think, gee, if she could have only gotten a little dual out of that, ever that flight instructor thing. It's amazing too, the people that you meet in aviation, you never know, because the head of the clinic that did her work happened to be a client of mine that I worked with on his private, now since then his instrument rating. So you just never know.
Just never know.
He was a neurosurgeon, and he called, he heard about what happened to me, and he called John at, you know, you think 11 o'clock that night. And
from Boston.
He was in Boston, and he said, hey, you know, I heard about Rose, and he said, you know, we're going to get the A team on her right away. And which I kind of thought was funny later, because I thought, I think everybody gets an A team when you're
right.
working on something like that. But it was a very sweet thing that he did. And, and since, you know, we've become closer friends, and he and his wife. And so that's very nice. I like to share this story because so many times when you hear of someone having a ruptured brain aneurysm, they don't survive. And I think it's important that people know you can survive as long as you get medical help right away. And, you know, I mean, it's not my plan. I mean, it's God's plan, of course, but still you can work with him a little bit to make sure, you know, those odds are better. So, and it is hard to talk about it, like John said, a little bit sometimes. But you know, it's been, 3.5 years. And so now, you know, so everybody asks, okay, are you going to go back and get your commercial? Or are you going to go back to flying? And right now I'm just not ready to go back to flying. I've always been active in so many different things, you know, and right now I just feel like I'm not ready to go back to flying, and who knows, you know, I may in the future.
But I did,
and I think what you're probably about to say is I did talk to folks at the FAA, and they were nothing short of amazing as far as being supportive and you know, sharing the right steps to take to try to get the medical back. I talked to the neuroradiologist, and he said he has worked with other people who have had ruptured brain aneurysms and were able to get their medicals back. And so I, you know, I feel like it's in the cards
just a short story, Chris. So we're convenient with AirVenture about 6 miles away, but during AirVenture, let's see, was that 2017 or maybe 18? So it was shortly thereafter, after the incident. And so we go into the FAA building and we wait in line, and we at the medical area, right? So I say, hey, we want to talk about what the process is to get a medical back after a significant medical issue. And so the gentleman that was kind of first up in the queue said, okay, sure, we can talk about that. What was the incident? And so I explained it, and he goes, he happened to be from the Chicago regional office. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, let me get a coworker who's actually worked some of these instances, other cases of cerebral hemorrhages. And so I said, okay, so this woman comes up and we're talking, and she said, wait, is she the patient? And points at Rose. She comes around from her desk, gives her a big hug, and says, I've never seen anybody that good that soon after the incident. Mm-hmm. So for at least this one person, boy, we got a lot of heart in a lot of the FAA people. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of nice.
And then the other gentleman from Kansas City as well.
Yeah, so he's the was or is the Central Region Medical Office
Surgeon.
Yeah, like he's like kind of like the AME for the region.
Gotcha.
And we talked to him. Now we'll fast forward to about a year and a half later. And so now she's kind of ready. Okay. And we're thinking, because she didn't renew it, she never really lost it. She had this incident. So what do we need to do? Kind of thing. She never lost her medical when I said it.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked to the regional medical director, and he says, well, first of all, let me tell you, it's kind of a replay of the Chicago person. He says, if you were to walk up to me in the office, the way you presented yourself, that was his term. He said, I've written you a third, second, or first class, whatever you wanted to do. He said, you look fine, you're talking fine, all your responses are normal. So that was kind of encouraging. And he says, so how long has it been? And he said, so all we'd really need is a package from your neurosurgeon, mm-hmm. And then in your AME to do the exam, and then of course don't have the AME issue anything. Send it all to whether it be Chicago at the Great Lakes region or at the Central region, and they would handle it themselves there and kind of act as an intermediary. So just great, wonderful news, great and wonderful service.
Great. It was all great, wonderful, but I still haven't actually, you know, John. I mean, I pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. I guess
Right.
I mean, I've been flying with John, but I don't know what's holding me back a little bit. But I'm not ready to start flying again. I mean,
yeah.
I don't mind flying with him, but acting as PIC, I've got some sort of little mental block right now, I guess, where I'm just not ready to do it.
You're still in the left seat and still flying.
Yeah.
I'm just over there, you
right.
know, taking space. But and I can kind of understand that coming that close, you know, do you want to, although the doctors will tell her, and every time she goes in for an annual check, the odds of having another one aren't very
high. It's about like 3%. It's very, very low. It's 3% of people who have had a ruptured brain aneurysm may develop another one. And that's why I get a CT scan every year for, you know, a few more years. And then I think then it's maybe every 3 to 5 years, I think, just to make sure. I've always loved everything aviation, and I still do. So it's hard to think that I'm not flying right now, but, you know, I'm, this sounds crazy, but I've always wanted to learn how to crochet. So I took a crochet class in December, and now I can't stop crocheting. And I've got four grandkids, and I, I'm having a lot of fun with them, we're playing the ukulele. I'm learning to play the ukulele lately. I mean, you know, I'm doing a lot of other stuff. But, you know, it's like my mind is always thinking about flying, and, you know, someday maybe I will.
Well, it's not like it's totally out of your life. Like it's still part of your family makeup. You know, John's doing it, and you're probably usually going to fly with John anyway if you go. So it's like,
yeah.
You know, a bit of a safety net. I totally get it. That would really, really set me back too. And I'd second guess going up again. So
yeah.
I think there's lots of lessons there though. Like, If you don't mind me saying, just we're, you know, collectively here, we're people of great faith, and I see miracles in there with how close the fire station was. You know, I did my training probably in the same airplane, 777 or whatever.
70 Golf.
Yeah, 70 Golf. And then the fact that, so the Thetan, is it called, what is it called again?
The Theta Star is the name of the helicopter operation.
Helicopter, and Theta Care is the hospital. So,
but it, they have like a specialty division there for neuro issues. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. They have a, the neuro ICU. And honestly, I could have gone to another, I could have gone to a hospital because they said they asked John if, yep. if there was a preference because there's a neuro ICU in Appleton as well. But Theta Care is very well recognized. And so that's where I was. And
it's a regional trauma center. So I figured, hey, we're pretty close to trauma.
Yeah.
Let's go to the there. And it worked out really well.
And then John's student was there. I mean, just kind of one thing after another, it kind of the perfect calming of the storm, I guess you could say, not the perfect storm, but yeah, it's, and then, you know, even kind of a lesson for people that maybe get in a position where they can't or are apprehensive to actively fly. It's a good lesson that you can still enjoy aviation by having an instructor and doing it that way, that you don't just have to get kicked out. And if you are apprehensive, you can work your way back in a more comfortable environment. Cause I know that I would feel the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's probably going to, you know, I mean, I think, it'd be the most beautiful success story to say, yeah, but I got back in the airplane and now I'm a commercial pilot. And I can't even imagine right now of going back and doing all those maneuvers and remembering what happened half hour late after I did those maneuvers, you know?
Yeah.
But I do feel like I should do that one of these days, but I think it'd just be great to just go out and do some touch and goes together. And right. I don't have to go and do, you know, Shondells or
yeah, full on thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So like you said, having him next to me is a good thing. And if that's all the flying I ever do when we're together, you know, I'm okay with that.
Right.
But it's not the same as being able to just, you know, be able to go to the airport and hop in the airplane and fly somewhere. So
I think to your point though, Chris, too, even if you're not in a relationship with a pilot, there's still ways to stay in aviation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be organizations or a community, whether it's your airport community or maybe you're a teacher, you know, assistant, and you teach aviation concepts or something. There's always a way that you can stay in aviation and, more importantly, give back.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you might have to look a little bit, but there's ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. And I know you guys are very active in aviation, and you even outside of the aviation, like when I was there, I saw the outpouring of love, you know, people checking on Rose constantly, seeing how she's doing. Everyone in Wisconsin, it seems, new, at least in the aviation space, and we're asking about her. So, you know, really the aviation community, especially if you connect with like the grassroots community, like general aviation, very, very supportive, and not just in Wisconsin. Right. I think that's a lesson for everyone that it's not just in Wisconsin, it's everywhere.
Yeah,
exactly.
It really is a beautiful thing. And it means a lot, you know, when you're going through something like this and people are reaching out with encouraging words and, you know, just checking in to see how you're doing. And I mean, people who I hadn't heard from in ages, you know, checked in and say, hey, I heard what happened and I hope you're doing well. And a lot of those people, like you said, were from the aviation community. So, yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So
great.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think I've ever gone so long in a podcast without just saying a thing. I just listened to your whole story and sat back and it was very compelling. And thank you for sharing, 'cause I know that's still gotta be a little bit tough in some ways.
Yeah.
So Rose, what would your words of advice, kind of to finish up here, what would your words of advice or encouragement be to people that are A, getting in the aviation, or B, people that are maybe coming up against something that's difficult, could even be a medical thing, and just encouraging words to help them get started or push through?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, if you're passionate, you just got to jump in and do it, you know? And, you know, I always hear the, you know, eat it, live it, breathe it, sleep it, whatever. And I really believe that. I think whether it's flying or learning how to play the ukulele or whatever, I mean, you got to be passionate about it and hang on to that passion, whether you're training or you go through a medical issue. Just be passionate. And those are the things that really carry you through. Prayer helps, and, you know, knowing you have a lot of good people around you who care about you, you know, that all makes such a difference too. So don't be afraid to reach out to people. I tend to be the type of person who doesn't want to ask for help, you know. Mm-hmm. I always think I can get through this without, you know, I don't need to ask anybody, you know, but I'm 58 years old now. And I think I'm kind of finally catching on that it's okay to ask for help sometimes with different things. And, you know, even with John and I, we're working on projects around the house. And I think this would be so much easier if I would just go ask John, but I don't want to ask him. I'm going to do this myself. You know? but I suppose that's a long winded, response, but yeah, I mean, be passionate, be, prayerful, and you'll get through it. So,
and I like that, because honestly, I ask that at the end of every episode, and no one has ever said be prayerful. So I do actually appreciate that.
Yeah, well,
because it does matters. Make difference. It does. It does. All right, John, you want to meet up soon and do another podcast, you and I?
Whenever you're ready, you know. I just hate to talk, so.
can I go back one more time?
Yeah, absolutely. Go back.
You know, I think it's important if we can just real quickly talk about the symptoms of a ruptured brain aneurysm, because they are rare, and a lot of people aren't aware. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can make this kind of an awareness thing, this is a good opportunity to do
absolutely,
so.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, we talked about the sudden severe headache that I have. I mean, that's the number one. If people say this is worst headache I've ever had, that's usually a good indication that you've had a ruptured brain aneurysm. But you may have the sensitivity to light. You might have like drooping eyelids. I don't think that's as common. The vomiting is common. And that was for me, probably the worst part, because I can still remember that.
She worries about that 3.5 years later.
But anyway,
she threw up on a fireman. Oh my goodness! Right?
but I think it's, you know, the stiff neck, the sensitivity to light, the extreme headache that comes on suddenly. I'd like to kind of share that, because it's kind of an important thing to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Technically, she didn't have a stroke, but the FAST acronym for stroke. The last one, T, is time, and that's speedy response to get to a healthcare. And I think that's what really set the stage for us, is we were literally probably 3 minutes or less before we had the paramedics looking at her, in maybe 12 minutes before she was in the ER at the hospital.
Yeah.
So those things, as Rose said, if you got these symptoms, somebody says, "Hey, this is the worst headache I've ever had," don't wait. It's much better to be embarrassed, like throwing up on a fireman, that nothing, you just got a bad headache, than to have died because you didn't respond quick enough. You know, we don't see those things in GA, and we don't have the opportunities. I see those in GA as a pilot. What would we do if something like that happened on a flight? Whatever it is, we should try to find a place close by that's got some medical service that we can get to. And again, time is of the essence.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually a good point, is how do you prep it in flight to have someone there? And people don't like to go there, but to declare an emergency, which is the lowest, you know, just do it. But then to ask them to have people there, like ready, is something that people can set up too. So give the people on the ground time to be there as well.
Yeah, because literally we were probably 5 minutes away from that happening.
Yeah.
It could have easily happened while we were flying, when you consider how soon after we landed. If you think emergencies don't happen, they sure do. And be ready. So.
Yep. Well, thank you for that message, and thank you for offering that awareness, and you're an inspiration. I'm sure people will find that through this podcast too. And
thank you, Chris. It's
pretty amazing. Yeah, pretty amazing. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. And we appreciated you and Chelsea, you know, praying and checking in every now and then. It was a wonderful thing. So
friendship is nice.
Friendship is good.
Yeah. It's very important. All right, you two. Thank you so much for doing this, especially you, Rose, since it was kind of a vulnerable thing to do. And again, I know it'll be helpful for someone. And I will talk to you guys soon. Hopefully see you guys soon too.
Looking forward to
it. Wonderful.
Thank you. Right.
Bye. Bye.
All right, everyone. Thank you for joining on this episode of AviatorCast. Again, thank you to Ron. Let me start that over. All right, everyone. Thank you for joining on this episode of AviatorCast. A huge thank you to John and Rose Dorsey, especially Rose, for telling her story. She kept it together. I know it's a scary situation and something that was literally life-threatening. And just so many lessons that we can learn in aviation about persevering, about the good people around us that help us. I think at this time as well, we're all very keenly aware of first responders and those on the front lines of, say, the virus right now. These people were there years ago and have been for us all this time. They were there on the front lines in a very big way for Rose, and did such an amazing job and acted so professionally and clearly. She also had some other help from a higher place as well. So again, thank you to John and especially Rose for joining us today. And please leave a review for the show. Engage in the community. I'm here to interact with you guys, and this isn't just one way. So I'd like to hear if you need any help or if this story affected you in a positive way. I'd love to hear that as well. All right. I will see you guys on the next episode and speak with you then. Until next time, throttle on.
We sincerely thank you for joining us on AviatorCast. Please subscribe through your favorite podcast service and leave a review. Check out more flight training resources at angleofattack.com. There you can find this podcast, many free aviation training videos, as well as online ground school for private instrument, commercial, and CFI. Got a check ride coming up? Check Ride Ace from Angle of Attack is your ultimate companion, guiding you through the process so you can conquer your big day. Thanks once again for joining us on AviatorCast. Turn left, contact Ground Point Niner.